I'm Afshin Rutansi. We're going underground as members of Britain's royal family finish a four-day visit to Cuba, seemingly defying Donald Trump's ramped-up economic war with the Caribbean island, infamous for opposing imperialism all around the world. Coming up on the show, the editor-in-chief of WikiLeaks defends his organization from allegations made by U.S. President Donald Trump's attorney general in his conclusions to Congress, summarizing the work of U.S. special counsel Robert Mueller. And the architect of the 2015 Paris Agreement, Cristiana Figueres, on claims it presaged a $100 billion investment in fossil fuels by the biggest energy multinationals on Earth. All this and more coming up in today's Going Underground. But first, Brexit is certainly crowding out news of continued attempts by Britain and the EU to overthrow the government of oil-rich Venezuela. Here is the president of the Adam Smith Institute just before the EU arguably violated international law.
We all have a part to play. What must happen now is that a bandit government must be replaced by a competent and responsible one.
But what about responsibility here at home in Britain? Because on Monday's Going Underground, a British doctor actually accused that institute that's led by that man of deliberately planning a hidden destruction of the NHS. We had been investigating the May 15th NHS deadline for doctors in Britain that could mean the end of Britain's universal healthcare system as we know it.
You have the Adam Smith Institute document, The Health of Nations, which spell out how to get from a public service to an insurance-based service over time without too many people noticing.
Well, the Adam Smith Institute got in touch with us about that allegation. They said, in this case, these allegations are entirely founded and true. We do proudly and with much gusto support moving the NHS from a failed socialist model that rations healthcare to a private insurance model with treatment free at the point of use. The NHS is a monopoly that does not provide comprehensive or high-quality healthcare. A social insurance scheme needs to be introduced, funded by employer and employee contributions, along with co-payments from patients for elective procedures, just as we do with opticians and dentists. That's the Adam Smith Institute, unequivocally standing by its principles. And who is associated with the Adam Smith Institute? No less than the people with an arguably disproportionate influence over Britain's Brexit negotiations. Here's UK backbencher Jacob Rees-Mogg at the Institute.
What I want in my stocking on Christmas morning is a Brexit deal for us to offer to the European Union.
And someone who has also addressed the Adam Smith Institute is none other than Brexit Amendment co-author Oliver Letwin, with arch-Blairite Red Tory Yvette Cooper, who also wants to overthrow Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn. It is Letwin who, because of indicative votes, is cited as the real Prime Minister of Britain. Here he is at an event hosted by the Adam Smith Institute-linked Centre for Policy Studies, explaining how Margaret Thatcher changed the Labour Party.
The great triumph of Mrs. Thatcher, of course, I don't go into this in the book, wasn't anything to do with me, but was to convert the Labour Party to the belief that it had to buy into social market liberalism if it was ever to have power.
Well, Dr. Bob Gill, who was on this show on Monday, did corner Letwin for his upcoming film, and here is a sneak preview of him questioning Letwin about the plans to privatise the NHS with big banks at the ready.
How about Anim Rothschild? Are they going to benefit from the privatisation? Have you got no comment, Mr. Letwin?
None whatsoever to your organisation, no, thank you.
Do you know there were 30,000 excess deaths in 2015 because of the cuts? Anybody going to take any responsibility for that? Mr. Letwin? There's a lot of people that are putting their lives on the line for the NHS, Mr. Letwin. Is it really worth all the money? All the death and destruction that we're seeing. Given you're the mastermind of the privatisation, I thought you'd have more to say. Mr. Letwin.
Well, one organisation that leaked secret documents about health services all around the world is WikiLeaks. And in the past 72 hours, US President Donald Trump's US Attorney General William Barr has submitted to Congress conclusions reached by Special Counsel Robert Mueller that directly attack the whistleblower organisation. Joining me now is the Editor-in-Chief of WikiLeaks, Kristin Hrafnsson, via Skype from Reykjavik in Iceland. Kristin, thanks so much for coming back on. Well, we now know the US Attorney General from him that your organization quotes publicly disseminated materials from obviously the Russian government hacking operations, quote, through various intermediaries, including WikiLeaks. Do you deny that?
Well, I mean, we've seen this claim before that WikiLeaks knowingly was cooperating with Russian agents in publishing the information from the Democratic Party in 2016. That claim is false, and there is nothing to substantiate that claim, and that hasn't changed.
Well, something must substantiate it, presumably, if the U.S. Attorney General is summarizing the conclusions of a report that's taken more than 2 years, is it, by the special counsel, Robert Mueller?
Well, there's a very, very, very interesting wording in the that you cited earlier. I mean, it is said that this is a material that Russian agents obtained through hacking or other means, and B, that it was disseminated through various intermediaries, including WikiLeaks. I have not seen any evidence substantiating the first half of the claim. It might materialize at some point, but it doesn't really matter at all for WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks is an organization that publishes information that it receives. If it's verifiable, if it's accurate, and if it's newsworthy, it is published, just like every journalist should do. Now, the second half of that sentence that you were citing is that it was disseminating through intermediaries, various intermediaries, including WikiLeaks. That's actually a rather positive acknowledgement that there were dozens of media organizations that were disseminating exactly the same information. But why singling out and mentioning WikiLeaks? If you go into details on that, I can name those organizations, the media organizations that were doing exactly the same thing as WikiLeaks, and should be mentioned there as well. I mean, the Guccifer 2.0 leaks, the alleged leak from that entity, was published by at least 11 media organizations, including the Washington Post, the Politico, the Intercept, BuzzFeed. Information that was said to be from DC leaks was published by 17 media organizations, including the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, etc., etc. And the material that WikiLeaks published was republished and stories written on it in 23 media organizations, including all the major media organizations in the Western world.
Including RT.
Including RT and the BBC and the NBC, the ABC, the New York Times, the Washington Post, etc., etc. So it was. So it's quite interesting that it's at least acknowledged that this material was published and disseminated through various media organizations. But why single out WikiLeaks? I don't understand that.
Except that if we leave it to one side, whether Vladimir Putin would have wanted Donald Trump as president, your own former media partners, the London Guardian, they have repeatedly said that one of their columnists called your organization basically useful idiots for Russia.
Well, I mean, who's the idiot? I mean, the Guardian printed a front page story saying there was no collusion. It also happens that the journalist that you mentioned, without mentioning his name is Luke Harding, published a book called Collusion, where he maintained that there had been collusion and the WikiLeaks one was in the midst of it. Now his own paper is now printing a front page story telling him that he was wrong. I mean, does he still have a job at The Guardian? This is the same individual that printed a story on 27th of November last year on the front page of The Guardian saying that Paul Manafort had somehow mysteriously sneaked into a secret private meetings in the Ecuadorian embassy on three occasions. Now, we're talking about the most surveyed spot in the most surveyed city in the world. Totally unthinkable that this could ever have happened, and The Guardian knew it. They have not tried to defend that story. They have not retracted that story.
As far as I understand, The Guardian stands by that story.
Well, they do stand by it by not retracting it and not answering any question. Everybody knows that this was a fabricated false story that had serious implications for Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. And therefore, we are forced to take them to court over that story.
Okay, but simultaneously, you are being taken to court by the Democratic National Congress, whose most prominent, arguable 2020 candidate is Bernie Sanders, despite your leaks, of course, contributing to our knowledge about how the Clinton campaign in 2016 tried to destroy the Sanders presidential campaign in 2016. What are you going to do about the DNC suing you?
Well, I mean, we are defending ourselves. So the organization has put up a defense, and it will be met in court and dealt with. That's the only thing to do.
But they're not suing the BBC or ABC or the New York Times. Who?
Not at all. Not at all. They're not suing the mainstream media on their home turf, who were disseminating exactly the same information, as is now acknowledged in the Attorney General's letter based on the Mueller report.
Would you still say that in the whole situation here, this has been a victory for anyone who wanted strained relations between Moscow and Washington? Russia says there's nothing to celebrate because sanctions and economic warfare continue out of all of this, even though it may be a complex labyrinthine connection to WikiLeaks and the DNC server.
I mean, who gained for this? I mean, this is a journey that was started in a panic reaction. We have confirmation that within 24 hours after the outcome of the election in 2016, the Democratic Party officials decided that they had to put a blame somewhere. Because it was a humiliating defeat against Donald Trump. And Russia became the entity that everything should be blamed on. And on that basis, we've had this frenzy in the media, an absolutely a neo-McCarthyistic era, which is a total humiliation for journalism. Who has gained? I can tell you who has lost. Journalism in general has lost. This is an extremely dark period for mainstream media, especially in the United States, and for those who cater to that market, such as The Guardian. It is much worse than the episode with the mainstream media swallowing the story of the alleged weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. This is even worse than the McCarthyistic era in the 50s. It is such a humiliation, such a blow to journalists. I have no idea how the mainstream media, who were most active in this Russiagate frenzy, will recover. I simply don't see that happening. In a normal world, a lot of people, a lot of journalists would be emptying their desks today and just quietly wind us off the scene. This is a horrible, horrible dark days for journalism in our country, in my profession, in our world. And I don't have any schadenfreude feeling on that. It's a sorry state.
Christian Harafinson, I'm going to stop you there. More from the editor-in-chief of WikiLeaks after this break. And we asked the architect of the Paris Climate Agreement about the billion-dollar lobbying budget of the fossil fuel giants. All this and more coming up in part two of Going Underground. Welcome back. We're still here with the editor-in-chief of WikiLeaks, Christian Harafinson. The whistleblower, Chelsea Manning. Donald Trump's national security advisor, John Bolton, called for her killing. And she's already been tortured. Do you think the Trump administration will try to kill her?
She's spent now 2 weeks in solitary confinement, which is an absolutely a horrible thing. We are seeing something happening that you do not expect to see in a country that calls itself civilized. I mean, for heaven's sake, this is something you should see in an authoritarian regime. She was court-martialed, she was sentenced, she spent 7 years in prison. Her sentence was commuted by a presidential decree, and now she is hauled back in front of a secret court, a secret grand jury, and in an attempt to force her, an alleged source, to testify against the journalist who worked on the material. This is absolutely unacceptable. And if the media in the U.S. had you know, if they want actually to regain some of the trust that they have lost, the entire trust, they should now start focusing on the situation of Chelsea Manning and the atrocity that she is facing now.
Chelsea Manning, of course, in solitary confinement in relation to the founder of your organization, Julian Assange, held in arbitrary detention here in London, as determined by the UN. What do you make of the perceived idea that this US Department of Justice jet that arrived in London, call sign N996GA, do you think it's a coded threat to Julian Assange?
It could very well possibly be. We don't know that for sure. We just pointed out the fact that this is a rendition plane. It was used to rendition an alleged Russian hacker from the Czech Republic last year. This is the first time, as far as we know, that this Department of Justice jet has landed in British airspace. And we're sitting there for quite a few days, and at the same time we're seeing increased activity outside the embassy of plain clothes officials. Part of that operation, which now probably has cost £24 million to the UK taxpayers. And this comes in the same period where the squeeze is being put on Chelsea Manning. We also know that several individuals that had even minor connection to WikiLeaks back in 2010 are now being sent what I call the Don Corleone offer, which is the mafia-style offer that they can have immunity if they testify against Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. This is an outrageous thing. This is a threat to individuals, U.S. citizens, who are now basically living in exile as refugees in several European countries. So the signals are there that that this might be approaching an even more serious situation. We of course know that Lenin Moreno in Ecuador is willing to sacrifice Julian Assange even for debt relief. That was reported in the New York Times in early December.
You see a connection between the government of Ecuador, which gave asylum to Julian Assange, and perhaps the IMF deal, the Washington IMF deal for Ecuador?
It could possibly be that there's a connection there. We don't know all the details of what has been going on behind closed doors, but we see that there is a total 180-degree switch in the when Lenin Moreno took over from his predecessor. And the hostility towards Julian in Ecuador's embassy has increased. He has been stripped of communication for weeks on end. There are limits on the visitors that can see him in the embassy. And he is basically now treated like a prisoner instead of the individual that was granted diplomatic asylum, which carries responsibility according to international law. International law that don't seem to apply to many countries, not even the United Kingdom, who disregards international law when it suits them.
Christian Hrafnsson, thank you. Well, WikiLeaks has again and again exposed manipulation by U.S. authorities of international accords, including those seeking to save the Earth from climate change destruction. But while U.S. embassy dispatches reveal the use of spying, threats and aid promises, the entire international environmental paradigm has arguably now been thrown into turmoil by this man.
The bottom line is that the Paris Accord is very unfair at the highest level to the United States.
Well, joining me now is the architect of the agreement that President Trump tore up, Christiana Figueres. Christiana, thanks for coming on. So tell me, first of all, about this event in London today that you're speaking about 3 years on from that Paris Agreement.
Well, it's 3 years and a little bit on from the Paris Agreement, in which we explored how we have actually progressed on, certainly on technology development, on policies, on some countries that have actually already over-complied with what they said they were going to do in Paris, and some countries who are not interested in taking advantage of the benefits of decarbonization.
Has Britain over-complied?
Britain is very well on track.
Excellent. That's good to know. Then why are all these children leaving school on a Friday every weekend, and why is all the traffic brought to a halt by organizations like the Extinction Rebellion if things
are
going on track?
I am very grateful for all of those demonstrations on the streets, because this really is about that generation. We are trying to change the course here of the economy onto a low carbon or no carbon economy, but that generation that is out there on the streets are the ones who are going to have to finish the job. I had my two young daughters with me in Paris just to remind me every single day, why are we doing this? We're doing this for future generations. We're decarbonizing the economy for them. We're not doing it fast enough. And that's why they're on the streets, because we're not doing it fast enough. The political compromise in the Paris Agreement states the objective as being well below 2 and an aspirational objective of 1.5. But may I be the first one to say that clause in the Paris Agreement is now obsolete. We have to change that, and we have to make sure that we're going for 1.5 and not below 2.
You must have known that secretly in Paris and at the deal before, because
we knew many secret things.
That it was 1.5 degrees. That it was.
Well, you know who knew that? Who knew that? And because that's why it is actually mentioned as an aspirational target in the Paris Agreement is all of the small island states, because they're the most vulnerable.
You see, in the political dimension, I'll get on to corporations in a second. President Obama, who I should add, fought to impose CO2 standards on power plants, on standards for oil refineries, opened up public lands for coal. She is saying, you know, very dangerous for these sorts of new Congress people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez touting Green New Deals. This could mean electoral problems for the Democrats. Is that short-sighted?
Well, I haven't seen the exact wording.
Forget about Trump. You've obviously criticized Trump already.
I haven't seen the exact wording from President Obama, but let me be very clear that he really understands climate change. He is very, very aware of the fact that it is a huge threat, both for the United States as well as for globally. Whether from a political fine-tuning point of view, he finds that some aspects of the Green New Deal that, by the way, go way beyond climate change into a much more holistic and comprehensive view of the future, whether he finds that some of those things are not very helpful right now.
Socialist, I think probably, probably say. On the corporations, a report just this week back by the Roundtree Foundation, Influence Map, claiming that since your Paris climate deal, there's been $100 billion of investment by major oil and gas companies in fossil fuels, 10 times the amount spent on low carbon investment. Why do you think that could have happened after the Paris climate?
Why do I think that is happening? For a very simple reason, and that is oil and gas companies are oil and gas companies. That is what they have been doing for decades, right? It's a little bit as though you say to a person who has been making boots for 30, 40 years, excuse me, tomorrow, no more boots, you're now going to make sandals for the beach. Yes, both are for your feet, but it's a completely different enterprise. And what we're expecting from oil and gas companies is actually to change their business model completely. I think at least the European oil and gas companies have totally understood that if they want to have a future in the 21st century, they need to get with the program and move over away from oil first, on to more gas versus oil, and then to understand that natural gas
is
actually
being nice to the European ones.
Well,
this is Exxon, Shell, Chevron, BP, and Total.
Well, the Europeans are definitely much more understanding of the transition that they have to make. So they're beginning to understand that responsibility. They're beginning to invest into renewables, into buying battery companies. They're beginning to invest into what I call biological carbon capture and storage, which is the capacity that our trees have of capturing CO2 and putting it into soil. So they're beginning to make that transition. Are they doing it fast enough? Frankly, no one is doing it fast enough.
Well, obviously, China is saying complete ban on fossil fuel cars is what China's
government put a date on that, but as soon as that date is there, it's going to be really remarkable for the automotive industries, right? Because we already know that Norway is complete. You cannot buy an internal combustion engine in Norway today, in 2019.
Right now, they're worrying about the internal combustion engines not being produced here post-Brexit. I want to get on, and it's sort of related. So since your Paris deal, $1 billion at least has been spent on branding and lobbying by these sorts of companies. What is the role of lobbying for the internal combustion engine, say, against what you just said?
There are two kinds of lobbying. One is the lobbying that companies, oil and gas, or any other company of any other sector does directly on its own, and that's already bad enough if it is against climate change science and policy. But the other, I think, much more pernicious lobbying is the lobbying that is done by associations of particular sectors where companies are members, behind which they can then hide. That is even more pernicious, because if they're going to be very straightforward and take a position in front of policy, then let them stand up to that and let them stand to the public price that any company would pay for that kind of lobbying. But to stand behind associations, I really think that is unacceptable.
So do you get taken out to dinner all the time by these big companies? I mean, if there's $1 billion, presumably having someone like you favor some element of climate change would be useful. How does the lobbying actually work at the coalface, if you pardon the metaphor? Because politicians certainly are on the record in European countries and capitals for having meetings with these big groups that say climate change is a hoax.
Yeah, I actually think that it's even worse in the United States. And I think that is the reason why oil and gas companies in the United States can afford to still be as completely irresponsible as they are, because the lobbying there really is having a much, much stronger effect on policy, because there's a White House that is listening to that. In Europe, the lobbying, I think, is beginning to move because they're beginning to understand that there is opportunity for them in a new low-carbon or no-carbon economy, and it's not quite as pernicious as it is in the United States. That is one part of the reason. The other part of the reason why oil and gas companies in Europe can move faster than the United States is because the shareholders and the investors in those companies are actually putting pressure on them.
And looking back on it, what is the role of greenwash, as it's known? I mean, if you're a customer in a supermarket, I mean, I don't know what your feeling was when BP changed its logo to a flower. Shell this week has announced 700,000 UK homes are going to have renewables. Critics are saying the 3% discount is too little, and I think only less than 5% of revenue is on renewables. How can consumers be aware of whether they're being told the truth?
I think the truth of some companies, not of all, and I think, you know, the U.S. doesn't, those U.S.-based companies really have very little to save them. But I think most companies are straddling two realities. They're straddling where they came from, and let's remember that that's the kind of company they were. And they're straddling on the other side, where are they going to go, without truly having a very clear idea of how are they going to totally reinvent themselves. But we have to understand that, especially with oil and gas companies, but also with many other companies in related sectors, we're in a transition period. And transitions are, by definition, messy. Now, that's the patient part of me. The other part of me, which is the impatient part of me, knows that what science is saying is we've run out of time. We cannot play with these factors anymore. We cannot play with these uncertainties. We have got to accelerate. So, and I think that companies understand that as well and are currently caught in the headlights, if you will, of which way do they go.
Christiana Figueres, thank you very much. That's it for the show. Keep in touch by social media. We'll be back on Saturday as 1 million Palestinians march under threat from British-backed bombs and bullets on Gaza's border to commemorate the 1-year anniversary of the start of the Great March of Return. See you then.